This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We appreciate you tuning into Trumpet Hour today for our first Week in Review episode of 2019. And our panel of trumpet writers have plenty of important stories rounded up from the week that they're looking forward to bringing us up to speed on. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us from the UK is Sam Livingston.
Hello.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, 2019 is here, and we'd like to keep the episode today focused on the week just ending for the most part. But where we can, we will take this chance to look ahead a little bit to 2019 and just to consider what to expect for the year. And our first story is one about the Middle East that really does point to a volatile year ahead for this region that's already quite susceptible to volatility. For this, we'll go to our Middle East Bureau and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it is really interesting to look at this oncoming year and the questions that are on everybody's mind, and that relates to how involved the United States is going to be under President Trump in the Middle East. He gave a important press conference, or I guess it was a cabinet meeting that he had on Tuesday, where the press was present, and then he spoke for about 20 minutes about his policy in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, related to Iran as well, and related to a lot of things. It was very candid. It looks a lot of political commentators, Middle Eastern commentators, are very perplexed by his policy, for they see it as something that is kind of a little bit destable in the sense that it could change. It's like the president doesn't really know what he is going to do, apart from the fact that he wants others to pay a lot if the U.S. is going to be there. They should be paying for U.S. troops to be there. And he doesn't want U.S. troops in the region if they are, wants to bring them home as fast as he can. And those two points in themselves aren't necessarily bad to get others to foot the bill if other nations are benefiting from U.S. troops being there. But it seems he's just looking at foreign deployments in terms of economics, whereas he is willing to, in terms of that, he's willing to outsource a lot of the work that the United States usually does in the world. And he is basically saying, in terms of Afghanistan, why isn't Pakistan doing more? Why isn't India doing more? Why isn't Russia doing more? They're all benefiting from us there. They should be doing more. We should be getting out. In terms of Syria, why aren't our other allies there? And why are we even supporting the Kurds? The Kurds are selling oil to Iran. We don't like Iran. And if anyone was just listening to that didn't know much about the Middle East, I think that they would have said, right on, Mr. President. But for anybody that understands the U.S. place in the world, that has been the main reason for peace throughout the Middle East, even in a volatile peace, we could say, that has been U.S. presence there. And so what's going to happen in 2019? Nobody knows. Nobody knows, which is extremely worrying for allies of the United States in the Middle East.
So I know with Syria, at least, there has been a little bit of back and forth with President Trump's stated policies. Initially, there was, this stated plan for a drawdown or even a complete withdrawal. But then that was reversed, and then it was possibly reversed again, and then possibly again. Where do you think that stands right now? And do you think that the U.S. will remain in Syria?
I think they will get out. It is put up to be about 4 months away by the time the 2,000 troops leave. Again, this is, I don't really understand why the big hoopla over Syria, given it was a pittance of money and not many troops, and extremely not dangerous in terms of loss of lives. Only four men have been killed in the past couple of years, the U.S. forces there. And what the big incoherence in the policy is the fact that Mr. Trump says that he's going after Iran, when these troop placements in the Middle East, they really do hamper Iran. They stop Iran, or they make it far more difficult for Iran to control the region. The Kurds typically don't like Iran, especially those in Syria. And you had the U.S. forces there in Syria that were stopping the land bridges we've talked about being created between Iran and the Mediterranean Sea, this roadway where they could funnel their troops through. And so while the president is right that the fight against Islamic State is going so well, the fight against Iran was still ongoing. And so that's why people wanted U.S. troops there, for they saw, even as Mr. Trump said, Iran's march across the Middle East, and this was the best way to stop that from taking place. Now, in terms of one thing he did say, I think that was very truthful, is he did say that before he came into office, Iran virtually controlled the Middle East, or was about to control the whole Middle East. And he believes that his policy has turned that around. He believes the nixing of the nuclear deal and the financial sanctions have turned Iran around, and that they're no longer able to do that, which is definitely very premature to be saying that. And it only encourages Iran when they hear this type of commentary from the United States that they're pulling out because the deal's the job's basically done on Iran. And so all they need to do is ratchet up financial sanctions, and it'll be fine. But that, especially in terms of Bible prophecy, is dangerous to consider.
Well, I know you said there that no one knows for sure the specifics of what will happen going forward. But before we jump into the prophetic significance of this, do you have maybe just any general areas regarding the Middle East for 2019 that you'll be especially interested in or particularly focused on? Maybe any predictions for the year or anything along those lines?
Well, I mean, Syria will still be a big focus just because it is so... a lot in Bible prophecy does revolve around Syria, that changing hands as far as who's in control there. I think with the president, I think he would be very up for offers from any of the allies to come along and say, hey, we'll take your missions. We'll put our troops instead of your troops there. Yes, we will contribute more. And he could be saying, great, look what I've done. I mean, the allies are coming in, and they're looking after the situation and not us. But what Bible prophecy indicates is that those allies that the United States thinks, at least right now, are allies, such as the Europeans, they're not allies of the United States in the long run. They will turn against the United States. And so paving the way for a European deployment, as he would like, in the Middle East, by United States withdrawal and Europe filling that void, that actually paves the way for Bible prophecy to be fulfilled, and a prophecy that will end up helping the fight against Iran, but definitely not helping the fight for Israel's sake. And so I would say, looking at Syria, we're also watching the Red Sea area right now. It is not in the news where it really should be. I think Anthony Chibariwe just gave a Trumpet Daily program this week talking about Sudan and the destabilized situation right there. I was going to talk about that, but he spoke about that for a good while on that Trumpet Daily show, and so I do encourage people to listen to that. But Sudan right now is very dangerous, that it could fall to radical Islamist elements, and we know that Bible prophecy talks about Iran shifting its strategy actually away from Syria to this Red Sea region, and that actually is more dangerous for the European powers, just because it does provide a way that Iran can threaten Europe by cutting off a lot of its trade through this territory. So I'll be definitely looking into that area as well.
We'll be sure to include a link to that Trumpet Daily episode about Sudan, which also sort of zooms out and looks at the Red Sea in general and just how geopolitically significant that region is. Is there anywhere else where you would direct listeners if they'd like to hear or read more about this?
Well, I think just going back to the booklet, King of the South, that's going to help us, especially in terms of looking forward for trends. That directs a lot of our focus here at the Trumpet, the King of the South booklet. As Mr. Trump stated, Iran is trying to dominate the region, and that's biblically prophesied, and that booklet really details that well.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Our next story is about some big developments in Germany as the nation continues its ascent to regional and even global power. For this, we'll go to our Europe Bureau and Richard Palmer.
We're right at the start of 2019, and already I have one pretty safe prediction for the year ahead. You're going to be hearing a lot more from Germany when it comes to foreign policy. And there were several things this week with that year, new year kicking off, that really underscore that. So firstly, right at the start of the year, January 1st, the German Chancellor traditionally gives an address to the nation, and Angela Merkel did this. And she devoted a fairly good chunk of that to talking about foreign policy. She talked about how she opposed Donald Trump and just about everything that he stands for. And she said, in such a situation, we must stand up more for our convictions. We must argue and fight for them. Mm-hmm. So aggressive language that we've gotten used to from Germany in recent months, but she's continuing that and definitely making that a priority by putting that in her speech. She said, and we must take on more responsibility in our own interests. She talked about all Germany was doing in spending money abroad, about how Germany was planning to spend more and do more with its military. She also talked about how she was planning to make the European Union, quote, more robust and more capable. So just continuing that focus on foreign policy in that speech. And the same day, we had some practical things that underscore that. So Germany took its seat on the as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council. It will be in place for 2 years. It was voted in by 184 out of 193 countries. So almost unanimous support there for its position on the Security Council. And at the same time, it also took over leading an important NATO mission as the spearhead country for NATO. So, you know, talking about foreign policy more, having that leading position on the United Nations, having that leading position within NATO, it means that people are, you know, they're in the spotlight. People are going to be turning to Germany now, asking, well, what does Germany think about this? What's Germany going to do?
So what does that non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council entail? Would that give Germany veto power with certain resolutions the way the five permanent members have? And also, what would it take for Germany to make that a permanent seat?
Well, so yeah, they don't, as a non-permanent member, they don't have veto power. It's only the permanent five that have veto power. And as a consequence, really, it's only the permanent five that actually matter.
Okay.
For the non-permanent members, it is a fantastic mouthpiece and megaphone. So as I said, it puts the spotlight on Germany. And it still has some significance. Generally, for example, permanent members don't like to veto things. If they can get a majority to oppose it, they would rather do it that way. They also like to use the non-permanent members as sock puppets, have them do the talking and proposing for them, because then it helps ruffle over feathers with some of the other permanent members.
That makes
sense.
So,
you know, it's definitely a spotlight position, but it also falls far short of a permanent membership.
Right.
But yes, they are pushing hard for a permanent membership. Deutsche Welle, they wrote talking about this, that over the next 2 years, Germany's main concern will be to try and ensure the European Union as a whole is given a permanent seat. They also wrote that many observers say that Germany should have a permanent seat, not least because the country has gained worldwide respect and recognition in recent years by participating in UN security missions, which the UN Security Council issues mandates for. And you can see the level of support that they have by that huge number that voted for them to be on the Security Council. So it's not a stretch to see something like that happening. Now, there have been quite a few people that have been pushing France to give the EU their permanent seat. You know, Emmanuel Macron's been talking a lot about European unity and sacrificing for a European superstate. And so both Germany and Poland kind of came out and said, well, okay, come on then, France. Put your money where your mouth is. If you're going to talk a big game on Europe, why don't you give your UN permanent seat up to the European Union?
So instead of being a French seat, it would become a European seat.
Yes, and France shot that down very quickly. They said, no way. I think really what Germany would like is for there to be a second permanent seat for the EU. The way they kind of view it is at the moment, France and the UK have permanent seats. So you've kind of got two EU permanent seats. With the UK leaving, there's some kind of arguing in Europe, well, to preserve the status quo and to have two EU seats, we need another one, either for Germany to gain the EU seat or for there to be an EU seat itself. So we'll see. I think it will be a big push over the next couple of years. Typically, Germany's also partnered with Japan, where the two of them have both worked together, petitioning for each of them to get permanent seats, which would be another very interesting result. But as I said, I think just the scale of their support for getting that non-permanent seat indicates it's not going to take, it wouldn't take too much for them to get another permanent seat. I mean, the main people they'd need to convince would be the US, Russia, and China.
Yeah, and if you look at just the sheer economic power alone of Germany and of Japan as well, it really would make sense for economies that are so massive and so integrated with so many other nations to have a permanent seat there. So as you said, it really looks like in terms of foreign policy, we're going to be hearing a lot more from Germany in the year ahead. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of that in terms of Bible prophecy and maybe just let the listeners know where they could go to learn more about that?
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating because obviously for years we've been saying, well, in general, Germany is going to rise. Germany is going to become more powerful. And Herbert W. Armstrong was, you know, right in May 1945, after the Soviet Union, after World War II and Germany fell, he's saying they're going to rise again. They're going to be a major power. And you can see they're coming back as a major diplomatic powerhouse. But then the Bible prophecy gets even more specific than that. It says that it's going to have a major role as a peace is in within, you know, diplomacy. It's going to have a strong reputation as a peacekeeper. Hosea chapter 5 talks about the little state of Israel there in the Middle East turning to Germany for help with its peace process, for example. And other scriptures talk about Germany entering the Holy Land as part of a peace process, and then you really using that as a springboard to boost power across the Middle East and just, you know, really take over. But they're turned to as a peacekeeping force. And, you know, as that Deutsche Welle article really alluded to, it had a whole section where it went through just all of the UN missions Germany's involved in, how it has this really strong reputation as being involved in UN peacekeeping missions, this rising protest or profile in diplomacy. We've seen that in recent years with the way that when everyone got involved in with the Iran negotiations, the format for that was the P5 plus one format, permanent five members of the UN plus Germany. You know, you see it being really boosted in stature in diplomacy and specifically as a peacemaker. So it really ties very specifically into Bible prophecy. In terms of where to go, our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, has a great section where it talks about Germany's role as a peacemaker in very specific terms, just like we covered. And then, you know, just keep up for the rise of Germany, just keep up with the Trumpet magazine. You know, the February issue has an article on a very similar subject. The title article of that new issue is France Rejects America and Empowers Germany, about this rise of Germany and this rise of Europe, because you see Germany turning against America, criticizing America in Merkel's New Year's speech. At the same time, they're taking on a big leadership role. And that's something Mr. Flores focused on in the last couple of Trumpet issues. So that booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy, and the free subscription to our Trumpet magazine, which, well, it's all free, and you can get all of that on our website, thetrumpet.com.
And we'll be sure to include links to both of those in the show notes for today's program as well. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. China is making ever deeper inroads into Africa. As the Chinese continue working to tap into African resources and labor markets and just trying to integrate the Chinese and African economies. But some worrying reports are showing that for some of the nations of Africa, China's investment is not always helping them. For the latest of these, we'll go to Sam Livingston.
Yes, so the latest country to fall into China's debt trap diplomacy, it looks like in 2019, will be Kenya. China has invested billions of dollars in Kenyan infrastructure projects as part of its One Belt, One Road initiative. The project in Kenya was to build a railway from Kenya's port in Mombasa to the capital, Nairobi. So Kenya accepts this big loan from China, and it looks like Kenya is not going to be able to pay that off. They're losing hundreds of millions of dollars. So again, we're just seeing this track record from China of giving these massive loans to countries that obviously it knows will not have the capacity to pay off these projects. It's been doing that with a lot of small islands in the South Pacific. And we've been seeing it especially more so in the last decade or so in Africa. I think Ethiopia has a similar project where the Chinese built a railroad from Djibouti to the capital. So a lot of these countries in East Africa, they're looking for investment. They're trying to get their natural resources to the coasts. And China is right there, obviously interested in those resources, those mineral-rich countries there. They want their railroads from the ports to go inland where all of the commerce is taking place. Really, though, it's like a new colonial power in that sense. It's taking over, filling in these nations right where the United Kingdom used to be and the British Empire. And you're seeing China just really manipulating these countries into taking these loans or giving them really to subprime nations there, and knowing that we're going to be able to use this as leverage to get more power.
So with the case of Kenya, what happens if they're unable to repay the Chinese loans there?
China does not. They gave them the money. They loaned them the money to build that port. Chinese companies built it. Now China can pretty much just take it for themselves.
Okay, so right. So this would equate to Kenya basically having to hand over some of its key assets to Chinese control, which would be, you know, a massive loss for the Kenyans, but a huge victory for the Chinese. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Just looking at this prophetically, we're obviously seeing the rise of the kings of the East, Russia and China. China especially in East Africa is making inroads over there, and they're really, you just see their empire expanding. They want to secure these vital trade routes. We know prophetically that we're living in the times of the Gentiles, so we see the demise of America and Britain in these areas of the world. Kenya is just another prime example illustrating the fall of Britain, and then now the moving in of China, this Gentile power. Again, you can see something similar happening a little further north in like Ethiopia or Djibouti, where I think China's main one military base outside of China is just across the city from the United States. So we're in the times of the Gentiles, and you see this Chinese superpower preparing to emerge on the scene as America continues to fall.
And we'll have a link in our show notes to an article on thetrumpet.com called China Preparing to Take Over Kenya's Main Port. And we'll also include a link there to our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which really takes a deep dive through all of the relevant Bible prophecies. Thanks very much for that, Sam. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And please visit our website, thetrumpet.com, to see more about the stories we're discussing today. In just a moment, we'll take a break. But first, Cuba celebrated a major milestone this week. They celebrated a major anniversary, and the leadership took the opportunity to take some disturbing jabs at the United States. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it's been 60 years as of January 1st since the Cuban Communist Revolution. For the vast majority of that time, Cuba has been ruled by two brothers, Fidel and Raul Castro. Recently, Raul stepped down but he's as president, but he's still the leader of the Communist Party, and took this time to chance to condemn the Trump administration for rolling back some of the Obama administration's outreach to Cuba. The Trump administration's taking a more confrontational approach towards Cuba, and for good reason. The Cubans have taken the event of the 60th anniversary to criticize that. But just a month ago, Mr. Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, was talking about what he calls the Troika of Tyranny. This is a group of nations comprised of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, all anti-American communist states on America's southern border that are close friends with each other, and also pretty good friends with Russia and China. Russia and China have been doing a lot of development in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, and for some pretty strategic reasons. All three of these nations, if you were to pull out a map and make that triangle, John Bolton referred to this triangle between these nations, that triangle would encompass most of the Western Caribbean Sea and would control the access points to the Panama Canal and the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, could you talk a little bit about the geographic location of Cuba and these other nations in the Troika there, and just why that makes it such a worrying development for the United States?
Yeah, because Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, all three of these nations in John Bolton's Troika of Tyranny, are extremely important just by virtue of their location. A lot of people don't think about it, but the North American continent is kind of like when God was making the earth, he almost must have shaped this specifically for a superpower to be housed here, because it's built like a medieval castle. You know, you have a medieval castle, you've got these high and fenced walls around the outside, and then all the good stuff's in the middle. And so North America, you've got the Rocky Mountains over here on the western side, and the Arctic tundra on the northern side, and the Appalachian Mountains on the eastern side, and then you've got Mexican deserts on the southern side. Mm-hmm. And right in the middle is the world's largest continuous tract of arable farmland. And not only is it this world's largest continuous tract of arable farmland, it's all interconnected by the world's largest navigable river system, funneling it right down to the Gulf of Mexico. So America, they can produce all this natural resource wealth and then funnel it out for export to the Gulf of Mexico. But now the ships need to be able to have safe passage, and so they have to go out the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico, which is dominated by Cuba. So Cuba's, it's almost like the drawbridge of the castle. It's how you get in and out. And then also, Cuba being the north there, you have the Panama Canal down south, that which allows all that wealth to be shipped into the Pacific Ocean, not just the Atlantic.
Right.
And so it was actually during Theodore Roosevelt's time in politics that he was one of the Rough Riders who helped America conquer Cuba. And then as president, he dug the Panama Canal. And so when you read the geopolitical thinkers of the time, this was all very strategic. They wanted the United States to be a superpower. They knew they had this defensed castle. They knew they had to control the world's oceans and trade routes. And Cuba and Panama were the key to doing that. That's why sometimes people call the Panama Canal the birth canal of America, because right, not as a nation, but as a superpower. And so now when you've got Panama is still a pretty good U.S. ally, but you've got Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba, these three anti-American socialist states that flank these strategic regions. Mm-hmm. And they're working together, and of themselves they don't have the power to withstand the United States, but if they partner with a major power in the Eastern Hemisphere like Russia or China, now you're starting to get the risk that they could use this Troika of Tyranny to start like a besiegement or start cutting off some of these vital trade routes.
And could you please place that in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they could go to learn more about that?
Yeah, because there's a verse in Isaiah 5:5, where God's talking about end time Israel, where he's saying that he's comparing it to a vineyard. And anyone who's listened to this program for a long period of time, or who's read Herbert W. Armstrong's landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, knows that this end time Israel is the United States and Britain primarily. And this prophecy is talking about the United States and Britain in the end time, where God compares it to a vineyard. And then he says in Isaiah 5:5, "I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down." And under Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's work in the 1960s, the Plain Truth put quite a bit of emphasis on Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba as the first breach in America's hedge. you've got this hedge. It's like I said, it's built like a castle. I compared it to a castle. Isaiah's here comparing it to a vineyard, but same concept. You've got the hedge protecting the outer sides and then the insides where all the good stuff is, and then you break a hole in that hedge, and then now all the wild animals and things like that can get in and eat up the grapes. And that's what God's talking about here, and what the plain truth was mentioning in this Cuban revolution is you've got an anti-American communist state who's right at the drawbridge of the castle. It's like a hole in the hedge. You get foreign powers using this troika of tyranny, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and you can start cutting off trade routes and getting into the breaking through that hedge of the vineyard and getting into the middle, which we can put in the show notes. Our book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. I believe it's chapter 4, if my memory serves me right, that's called Building Towards a National Catastrophe, where it talks about this prophecy in Isaiah, primarily Isaiah 22 and 23, about all these foreign nations, this great mart of foreign nations that team up against the United States to destroy it economically. And that book explains that group of foreign nations is primarily led by an Asian alliance led by China and a European alliance led by Germany that kind of team up together. But now you've got all these strategic nations on America's southern border, this troika of tyranny that are reaching out to the European Union somewhat, but China and Russia especially, that they could use to fulfill that prophecy.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes there. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we'll talk about how China's increasingly aggressive policy points to a tumultuous year ahead and political disarray in Israel. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Well, the first week of 2019 was a momentous one for China. The story that got the most press coverage here in the U.S. was China's successful landing of a lunar rover on the dark side of the moon, which was a first for mankind. But there were also several developments in China showing just how aggressive the nation is becoming. In the first half, we spoke about Chinese activity in Kenya and other nations that is really equating to, kind of a neocolonialism for the Chinese. That's a major trend that's sure to pick up more speed this year. But this week showed that there are plenty of other indications of Chinese aggression that point to a tumultuous year ahead. For this, we'll go once again to a man who normally talks about Europe, but who is conversant with geopolitics around the globe, Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's certainly been a busy week in China, which is why I've moved out of my lane a little. But yeah, some of the latest news, well, it started to hit the West this week. It really was December 20th, where Chinese Rear Admiral Lao Yan, he talked about sinking American aircraft carriers. He gave a pretty fiery speech. He said the United States is most afraid of death. And then he talked about some of the missiles that they have, their aircraft carrier killer missiles they have. They said, we attack and sink one of their aircraft carriers. Let them suffer 5,000 casualties. Attack and sink two carriers, casualties 10,000. Let's see if the U.S. is afraid or not. And you know, he's not really making these kind of speeches in isolation. China's president, Xi Jinping, obviously a much more high-profile figure. Just on Wednesday, he warned that Taiwan would be part of China by 2050, even if China had to take it by force. And he said unification was inevitable. The Times called it an unyielding speech. And people are taking note of this. There's an interesting article at the National Interest where the author there, he's a bit of a, I don't know, China declinist, I guess you could say. He's often forecasting an economic collapse in China. But he drew attention to just the shift in tone of Chinese statements when it comes to the United States. He quoted those same quotes from that Chinese rear admiral. And he says, well, he has a history of bellicose statements, but he is nonetheless seen as a reflection, as reflecting thinking in the senior ranks. And he said, in China, there is war talk, and not just from the officer corps. He talked about how many people are going back to this collection of speeches from Mao Zedong from 1938. These speeches are on protracted war, and it warned a country that in the midst of both civil and external strife, that the Chinese people would have to endure long hardships before prevailing over enemies. And he writes, at a time Chinese state media is full of venom for the United States, the current popularity of Mao's message is a warning. It is possible Chinese leadership figures are talking war as a way to prevail in factional infighting. But anyway, there's this growing climate of rhetoric against the United States. At the same time, there's a growing demonstration of capabilities against the United States. You know, we've seen this with – there's been stories just this week about China having a new rail gun debuted on one of their warships before the United States has got theirs going. I mean, if you like explosions, go on YouTube and look up railgun test firings. These weapons are pretty impressive. They just use electromagnetism to fire chunks of missiles for many, many, many miles, and they're not powered. The missiles themselves, it's just a chunk of metal, and they don't even need any explosives. They just travel so fast that whatever they hit is gone. But it seems like China seems to be getting some of the bugs on that.
Those are really amazing. It's like for the last 500 years or so, cannons and guns have relied on, you know, gunpowder exploding to propel the projectile. But suddenly these say, no, we can do that with an electromagnetic pulse instead. So, you know, it's not only far more cost effective, but it also can propel the projectiles at Mach 5, Mach 6, insanely fast speeds, which also equates to just a mind-boggling range for those weapons.
Yeah, that came up trying to tempt me away from Armstrong College years ago at Imperial Academy. Oh, at Imperial College in London, in their first year, they make rail guns, and it was a very tempting project.
Wow. Yeah, I can see how that would be enticing. It's fascinating technology.
But as I know you know, that there's a lot of other fascinating technology China seems to be, at least from what's publicly available, perhaps ahead of the U.S., hypersonic weapons as well. So for them to be talking with this kind of dramatic rhetoric, it is quite concerning, and there is the potential for them to back this up as well with more than just talk.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. Those comments that you mentioned by the rear admiral there in China, almost ridiculing the United States for fearing loss of life and kind of implicitly bragging about how little China would care about losing its soldiers. You know, that really confirms history. Just so many times throughout the ages, we've seen how little these nations care about losing soldiers. Once there's a Mao Zedong in power or a Joseph Stalin, someone along those lines, they're willing to sacrifice lives by the million in order to achieve their goals. So it is very sobering, I think, to see that spirit is still alive and well in China.
I think that's a really interesting point, because you see that same kind of attitude towards life. I mean, that's the same kind of statements you hear from like the Iranian regime. You know, we love death more than you love life, or I can't remember exactly how they put it, but that similar kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And you know, you look around the world and you see this growing hostility to the United States. Obviously, China is way more overt and confrontational than Europe is. Europe is talking about combating America economically. They're not talking about sinking American aircraft carriers. But there's the global, you know, this global turning against the United States. And that is one of the big things that we have been prophesying and been forecasting, that America would be find itself turned against by its allies, but then also that there would be an alliance of nations that turn against America, that Russia and China and Europe cooperate against the United States. And so this rise in anti-American rhetoric is exactly what you would expect from that. And the Bible tells us ultimately that China is going to cooperate with a European attack against the United States. I mean, you can see Isaiah 23 talks about them forming this mart of nations, this alliance of nations, and then Deuteronomy 28 talks about America being besieged, America having these sea gates, these choke points that so much of world trade travels through. It talks about America having them, and then it says, well, then your enemies will have them. You'll lose them. And you see all this hostile rhetoric from China, and it's all in context of sea gates, of the South China Sea, of Taiwan, of these gates that really America used to control. And then China is, in the case of these islands in the South China Sea, building new sea gates, pushing America out of, gaining control of the gates that, those were the gates of America's enemies. America used to have them. China's getting control of them now. You put all of this, these scriptures to get the big picture together. And yeah, you see this growing hostility and a willingness to fight with the United States. And that's what you're seeing building right now in China and elsewhere.
Is there an article or booklet that you would point listeners to if they'd like to know more about the Mart of Nations and the prophecy in Deuteronomy there that you mentioned?
This is kind of one of those interesting moments where I'm thinking, why, yes, it's one that you wrote. I mean, you probably have that in mind, but yeah, in the latest Trumpets print edition, we have one on exactly that subject, Brave New World, brackets, made in China, the way you can get the latest news on the rise of this Mart of Nations. One aspect of that, which is China forming these alliances with all these different countries around the world as part of the new Silk Roads. But that will, more importantly, it take you through what the Bible says about this rise in China and this trade alliance.
We'll include a link to that article and also one to Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, from our July 2016 issue. He wrote a very powerful piece that's taken on even more significance in the time since then. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. So we'll have a link to both of those. Our next story is really in this same vein, and it shows just how quickly China's becoming a technological giant, even in some ways that threaten the U.S. and sort of take control of areas that were once almost an exclusively American domain. For this, we'll go once again to Sam Livingston.
So today, I believe it was announced, China announced that they had landed a lunar module on the far side of the moon, or on the dark side of the moon. They are the first nation in history to successfully land a probe on the dark side of the moon. This is the side of the moon that faces away from Earth. This is obviously a difficult task because you can't reach whatever this module is when you have the giant rock that is the moon between you and this module. So what they did was they launched a satellite to orbit the moon to act as a relay for them to communicate with their lander. This just showed how sophisticated they are, or how sophisticated they've become with their space program. It's obviously a tremendous source of national pride to see your nation succeeding in this way. I don't have the quote with me, but I was someone high up in the Chinese government or in their space program that says or said China has done this, and the Americans have, it's something the Americans have never even tried to do. Kind of, just putting it in the face of America. Hey, we did this and you haven't even tried to. So it does definitely, it's a powerful illustration of how advanced China has become and really how quickly they've been able to advance here. I think this program has been just going on for, 10 or 20 years, developing these sorts of missions here. And now they're already talking about possibly sending a man to the moon or building a base up there. So you see China just this rising nationalist spirit there as they're all rallying behind their space program very excitedly there today. And then in addition to the lunar landing, China has also put its version of global positioning system. It has gone global, so it sent up something like 36, 37 satellites this year, in 2018, and now it has global coverage. And this system in the United States, we call it global positioning system, or GPS. In China, they call it their Beidou navigation system. And this, again, is showing China's growing dominance and as well as their independence. For 30, 40 years, it was really the United States and Russia who had these satellites that were capable of global positioning. I can't remember the name of Russia's program. And most of the world has relied on the United States for this sort of technology. At the start of the 21st century, the European Union and China began their own projects to launch these navigation systems, and China has moved very quickly with this. They now have more satellites up in space than the United States does. And this is a big deal when you're talking about national security, when you're talking about militaries. China can now offer this GPS service, you know, the same way you would have it in the States. They can now offer that around the world and challenge America in that way. They're no longer reliant on American satellites and an American system for their own navigating. So they're becoming more independent. America is being boxed out. And prophetically, we obviously know how these things, or how something like this will play out. The United States being phased out, China now independent, forming, again, like we've said earlier, this empire to where it is self-sufficient. And now it's demonstrating that it has the capability to operate on its own.
Yes, you mentioned how Beidou, you know, poses a bit of a threat to America's GPS system. And in Pakistan, I read a report recently showing that Pakistan is the first non-Chinese nation to actually be integrated into the military side of the Beidou system. And that allows, you know, the Pakistani military to have precision guidance for missiles and aircraft and vessels and things like that. And it does sound like Pakistan will now be leaving GPS. So that's maybe a bellwether for what we can expect with a lot of these nations, which will really reduce a lot of the U.S.'s influence with the GPS system that so many nations have long relied on. You mentioned the biblically prophetic significance of this. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, just like Richard had mentioned earlier, we have the Mart of Nations prophecy, and then there's the siege mentioned in Isaiah 23, and you can read about that prophecy in the Isaiah booklet. I believe it's now chapter 7 of that booklet, just describing how China and Europe will work together to essentially besiege the United States. And you can see that starting to play out. You can see the foundation of that forming right now as China and Europe develop their own independent systems. As you see Asia really uniting now more behind China and its own system, as you mentioned there with Pakistan, and the United States and Britain off on their own. And now we're seeing China and the European Union working closer together. And you can read more about that, like I said, in the Isaiah booklet in chapter 7.
Okay, yes. Yeah, that's that booklet is called Isaiah's End Time Vision. It's by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. Just a very powerful booklet that really places the context or places China's rise and the declining power of the U.S. and the U.K. in the context of Bible prophecy. So for anyone who hasn't read that, it's a very eye-opening book, and we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Sam. We'll go back to the Middle East now and to Israel, where the political scene is in disarray, with political parties splintering and feuds developing. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to our Jerusalem office and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, last week I talked about the probes into Mr. Netanyahu's rule, whether he had committed, taken bribes, committed fraud, things like that, corruption charges. And this week we heard from the Attorney General that it looks like he is going to make a decision on whether to indict the Prime Minister before the election. I spoke about how Mr. Netanyahu likely called early elections in April. They take place April 9th in order to ensure that he could be elected before the indictment comes down. And that's not going to happen. The attorney general is inserting himself into the political situation now. He's going to have a ruling on Mr. Netanyahu, whether he thinks he should be, those charges should go through or not. And so that's one element that's really destabilizing the situation. But there was a lot more that came out this week as far as the other political parties. They're one of the coalition members of with the Likud is the Jewish Home Party. That party split today or this week with Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked. They said they're going to break off, and they're the very vocal ones, the leadership of that party. They've formed a new party called Hayamin HaChadash, the New Right, and so they're obviously right-wing. They're publishing that fact. Carolyn Glick, somebody we quote often from the Jerusalem Post, she's actually joining that political party, so she is entering politics this year. We have the centrist party, the Kulanu party. They are breaking up. Michael Oren, who was part of that party that, again, they're with the prime minister, he is now out and he's looking for another job. And then you had the main opposition party that, in a stunning display this week, basically the two people that lead it, the leader booted out the deputy, Tzipi Livni. On live television, he was speaking and she was right next to him sitting down, and he basically said, "Hey, we're not getting along. Good luck in the next election, Tzipi. I don't know who you're going to be with because you're not in our party." And so, I mean, it was shocking to everybody just to see the way in which that took place. And so there's a bunch of new parties that are going to be in this election as well. And so what I think what's interesting about this is I haven't seen this before. I've lived in Israel for about 10 years. Israeli politics is generally a little bit more robust, I think, than you might see in the two political party system in the United States. But nevertheless, right now it's extremely fractured. And I think this, some people could look at this and say, well, this is, you know, the thriving of democracy. But it's not really, because there is a bitterness that is developing amongst the political class, that they aren't willing to deal with each other because of personality rather than policy. And so it's not just left and right. It's the left that's eating itself. It's the right that's eating itself. It's the centrist parties that themselves that are breaking up. And so it's just more of the same political destabilization and fragmentation that we're seeing across the Western world. It's taking place here in Israel as well.
Do you know what the main issues are that's fomenting all of this chaos and drama and disarray there?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I think it's personal animosity between a lot of these the political class. I mean, it's very rare for a new political figure to come into the whole political establishment here. These people have changed. They've changed parties as many years that they're in the Knesset. And so one year they're with one party, one year they're with the next. And so they develop these rivalries and bitterness towards one another that I think is dangerous, because you're going in a democracy, you're going to have to work with each other. That could be driving it. I think just a lot of these other leaders are sick and tired of Netanyahu ruling as well, and they're trying to figure out a way of getting rid of him, and so they are trying to develop their own political parties and just to come up with different strategies, I guess, to get rid of him as well. And there's a lot of policies on the table, internal policies on the table regarding the Haredi draft bill to get the ultra-Orthodox into the military. There's a lot of social issues. What's interesting about this is defense is not a main issue. Everyone on the outside of Israel would think, well, you know, surely defense would be huge. But in terms of internal politics, it's not in Israel.
So what do you think we can expect for the year ahead with Netanyahu specifically, and just the political landscape there in general?
Well, I think what we're seeing in Israel, it just highlights what's happening in the biblical nations of Israel around the world, be them United States, Britain, Australia. They're just three notable examples of a bitter fight that's developing among the leadership of the nation. There was a time when, although you come from different views and you're different political parties, you agree to work together and put personality aside, but more and more personality is it's more important than the policies. And I think that's a dangerous trend. You look at the strength of a nation. The Bible talks about a house divided cannot stand. That's what Jesus Christ said, and that's Abraham Lincoln quoted that for the United States. And so that's a policy that we see. You know, well, that's what we're seeing in Israel, in the United States, and Britain. And then you see like the nations that aren't Israel. You see Putin, basically, you wrote this week or last week, declaring that he might be able to come Tsar for life to change the constitution. That has already happened in China. You have this strong leadership developing in Erdogan and in Turkey, strongmen, and they're able to rule their nations. I'm not condoning the way they rule their policy, but you have a strength there. But the bitterness and the fight that we see amongst modern biblical Israelite nations, it's in the total opposite direction. It's creating weakness. And so I think Netanyahu will obviously, I think he'll survive all this. I think he'll still be in power. But there's a greater personal animosity amongst politicians that is being waged at him.
You mentioned the house divided prophecy, or the statement there that Christ made and that Abraham Lincoln applied to the U.S. during the Civil War. Is there an article or a booklet that you would point readers to if they'd like to know more about that?
Yeah, I definitely would go ahead and request our booklet, Character in Crisis. It talks about the link between character and leadership and the fate of a nation. And I think that's more important now than ever, Character in Crisis.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing today, and also to subscribe to our print edition and our email news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Sam Livingston, and Brent Noctegal.
It's been an honor.
Have a good weekend.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with some words from T.S. Eliot, who died on this day back in 1965. Poetry may make us from time to time a little more aware of the deeper, unnamed feelings which form the substratum of our being, to which we rarely penetrate. For our lives are mostly a constant evasion of ourselves. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.